You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM.
Vancouver specials. We all know those ubiquitous box-like houses. Some hate them, some ignore them. Some see them as emblematic of Vancouver's racial and class tensions. Some just call them home. Vancouver Special is the title of a book of essays by writer, activist, and stand-up comic Charles Demers, which looks at Vancouver itself with some of those same mixed feelings. Hi, Charlie.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. Now, why a book of essays about Vancouver now at this point in our history?
Well, this is, for better or for worse, and I would say for the most part, it's for worse. This is the year that everyone is talking about Vancouver, obviously because of the Olympic Games coming up and the mayor sort of running around the world with this kind of green capital idea. The idea is that everyone has their eyes on Vancouver. And so myself and Arsenal Pulp, who's a wonderful independent publisher based right here in Gastown, we sort of thought that it would be a good time to put forward a book that looks at Vancouver critically and looks at Vancouver honestly. From in my history, all I know of is people either kind of unquestioningly cheerleading for the city and, this kind of boosterism about world-class city, and it's usually to bring in something like Expo or the Olympics, or they're just completely down on it as this sort of cultural backwater, basically this kind of exaggerated suburb, but it just happens to have the mountains. I feel like the truth is both somewhere in between those two extremes, as well as on a completely different grid altogether. It's a pretty fascinating history with a city with an amazing history, a lot of incredible people, and a lot of horrible instances of racial and gender and class injustice.
Now, you're a comedian, and your essays are organized partly around neighborhoods. If you had to choose one neighborhood as being the funniest, as providing the most material for jokes, which would it be?
Well, I think that a good comedian wants a challenge. So I think that puts Yale Town out of the running, because it's too easy. A comedian can leave Yale Town to the civilians because it's just so brimming. It's like a piñata full of ridiculousness. But I would say, because if good comedy, you want it to be sharp but also have, a modicum of affection. So I would say probably Kitsilano. Kits has that, that echo of itself that, it used to be this sort of hippie mecca and political forward thinking and stuff, and when you go from being kind of Rainbow Road to the place where you go if you need to get your dog a leather jacket or a cake for its birthday, that's a neighborhood that's up for some teasing.
Quite a transformation,
right?
Now, the Commercial Drive neighborhood is personally important to you, and you see some humorous contradictions there as well. What are they?
Well, I mean, one of the, in a way, the contradictions of Commercial Drive are sort of what's nice about them. It's kind of the neighborhood that gives you a little bit of hope. And when you live in a city that's sort of built around stealing neighborhoods from people with no money and giving them to people with tons of it. Commercial Drive really is a mixed neighborhood in kind of the best sense. Not to say that there hasn't been, a certain level of gentrification and a certain level of putting things out of the economic reach of the people who've been there, but of the major groups that arrive at Commercial Drive, none of them have ever left. So in the 50s and 60s, it was the Little Italy and Portuguese neighborhood, and despite the waves of left-wing students and lesbian activists and these different kind of accretions of different kind of subcultures, those old Italian guys never left. They just kind of their shop is now next to a place that has djembe drum circles every hour on the hour, which is a pretty when you see a place where on one side of the street there's a bunch of 60-year-old Italian dudes playing cards in the back, and then on the other side of the street people are selling hemp Rasta hats to graduate students. That's a pretty funny neighborhood, but there's also some something really sweet and wonderful about it.
Now, we're sitting in one of the most talked about neighborhoods in Vancouver and in Canada, in fact, the downtown east side. You compare the downtown east side to Africa. How so?
I think that people in Vancouver talk about the downtown east side the same way that people in the west generally talk about Africa, which is one thing that they do is oblivious to the fact that they're causing the area most of its problems. They sort of wander around and have these like long, epic navel-gazing sessions where they try and imagine what it is about the psyches of the victims or what it is that they've done to bring about their own misery. When in fact, you know, the results of their misery is the very clear result of certain policy decisions that have been made. You know, they talk about it in the same way they talk about Africa, in the sense that some people talk about armed intervention, some people talk about charity, it's the Africa of Vancouver on the mental map. But you can also think of it as Africa in a more positive light, in the sense that in the same way that we all, you know, come from Africa. Vancouver comes from this neighborhood. This is the first. Vancouver starts, as you know, Chris Matheson will tell you when he does his Sins of the City walking tour from the Vancouver Police Museum, which is independent of the Vancouver Police and is a really fascinating place to check out. You know, this city cropped up around the people who wanted to sell booze and drugs and a good time to the guys who worked at the Hastings Mill. And Gassy Jack Dayton came in from New Westminster and set up his saloon. Others set him up, and it was such a raucous time. Again, as Matheson will explain, they got noise complaints from the North Shore. That's how raucous a time they were having. And, you know, people can, you know, the Lady Macbeths of Vancouver can try as they might to get that stain of working class history off the city and try and package it as this always safely upper middle class place where you can come and go skiing. But the fact of the matter is, this city has always been a working class city and has always had that history. And they can try as they might to get rid of it, but it's not going anywhere.
Okay, I'm waiting for that armed intervention in the
right. Yeah, well, you look around; it's happening everywhere. Everywhere you go.
Should be here in a month or so.
Yeah.
Now, something that connects all of these neighborhoods is food. What's unique about Vancouver gastronomically, and what do our food habits say about us?
Well, see, I've gotten into some trouble for saying that the buck a slice pizza is the kind of Vancouver street food par excellence. People say, no, you can get pizza by the slice in every city in the in North America, but the city, different cities sell them very differently. They sell these big, huge wedges of pizza that, you know, for $3 or $4. Vancouver has had this sort of buck-a-slice tradition of, you know, when I was a teenager, it was 99 cents, and I guess now it's like between $1.50 and $2 for a smaller slice of pizza, usually with some sesame seeds on the crust in the kind of Vancouver style. They're on every corner. It makes sense that they'd be on every corner in a city where everyone's supposed to be smoking pot, because people are hungry for pizza, and the people who sell pot need a place to hide money. So, you know, I think, you know, that's all just conjecture on my part, but it does seem to be a very helpful thing to have a lot of cash-only, hard-to-audit businesses around in a narco state like BC. Mm-hmm. So I would say that the buck-a-slice pizza is the sort of, is the Vancouver food. Of course, sushi as well is, you know, a pretty major part of the gastronomical landscape. Apparently, the whole white rice on the outside sushi was invented in Vancouver by Tojo, Chef Tojo, whose white patrons didn't want, they didn't like seeing the seafood. It kind of creeped them out, and so he wanted to sort of soften it for them. So, as I say in the book, just by being a little bit racist and as easy to fool as children, white Vancouver helped make sushi history.
You mentioned pot. What is pot meant to Vancouver?
Pot really is, you know, one of the things I say in the book is that it's like, it's sort of like beer is to Canada as a whole. We bristle when people try and reduce us to it as the cliche, but then it's everywhere, and it's stronger than it is in other places, and it feeds the city not only culturally but also economically. I mean, there's over $1 billion worth of marijuana related economic activity happening in BC, and that's only if you don't count hiring cops. So the number only goes up from there. So it's really been a huge part of our culture. It's been a huge part of the city. And, at the level of consumption, it's been a pretty harmless part of the city. And at the level of, economics, it's had a more deleterious effect.
Okay, your final essay is entitled Vanarchism, and you suggest there's a unique history of anarchist thought and action in Vancouver. Can you tell me about that history?
Yeah, around the sort of late 1800s, early 1900s, every major city in North America has, anarchist groupuscules and this sort of anarchist ethos on the left, particularly with the big influx of Southern European immigrants. But after World War I, they pretty much all kind of either crystallize as a more kind of authoritarian left or social democratic left that people either join socialist parties or communist parties, and the anarchist stuff is kind of left as being sort of a more kind of ethereal sort of moving spirit of political action. In Vancouver, all that stuff we have a real solid history of anarchist organizing here. The first union to form in Vancouver was formed by indigenous longshoremen on the Burrard Inlet who organized into a local of the Industrial Workers of the World, the Wobblies, an anarcho-syndicalist union organization. Throughout every epoch of the city, there have been these anarchist this sense of anarchist organizing, this sense of anarchist politics that, unlike other cities, doesn't go away. I mean, I was a kid when the Squamish Five, the Vancouver Five, were arrested and jailed. I was a teenager when anarchists led the anti-APEC stuff in going on in the city. One of my old professors, Mark Lear, has written, what's considered the definitive political biography of Mikhail Bakunin. Well, why would the definitive political biography of a Russian thinker who wrote in French in Europe in the 18th century be written by a guy who lives in North Van? Like, it's a special relationship that Vancouver has to anarchism that is really fascinating and unique.
Something in the air, I suppose.
Yeah, it's got to be.
What do you think is the reason for this ongoing anarchist tendency in political radicalism here in Vancouver?
It's sort of hard for me to put my finger on it, and I shy away from making too definitive a pronouncement on it in the book. Part of it is that we are a kind of marginal city to Canada. I mean, when you look at a map of Canada, it's almost ridiculous. I mean, Vancouver is practically in the water. It's just right on the periphery. But in a sense, I think that feeling of being away from where the decisions by powerful people are taken and made, there's a certain reversal of that, where you want to own that marginalization. Well, if we're not going to be anywhere near the power centers anyway, well, we just don't want power centers, period. And on the right in this province, there's very much a sense of a kind of a libertarian streak, that kind of frontier libertarianism. But I guess there is also that libertarianism on the left as well. And I think it also has a lot to do with the presence of the natural environment in Vancouver, which is so much more felt here than other parts of the country. It's hard to be convinced that human beings are more powerful than nature when, no banker can build a building here that's taller than the mountain. They will always be shadowed.
That's a nice way of putting it. Now, before we came on air, I was flipping through the book, and it's hard not to be struck by the beautiful black and white photographs which run through the book. Who was the photographer?
The photographer for the, and they really are, I mean, they're such a huge, huge part of the book, and they're so beautiful. The photographer's name is Emmanuel Buenviaje, and he is a tremendous, tremendous photographer. I when Arsenal told me that there would be, you know, photos, and I kind of, you know, imagined that there would be, you know, this book with kind of an inset of you know, a couple photos and stuff like that. And instead, they've really designed this incredibly beautiful object. The design was by Derek Barnett and Shyla Seller, and they really just put together a tremendous book. And Emmanuel's photos are he gets the city in ways that, you know, for instance, you know, my favorite shot is this kind of skyline view of Vancouver. Well, everybody takes the same skyline of Vancouver. It's the mountains with downtown, and that's the shot of Vancouver. Emmanuel has this shot that's taken from his parents' place around, you know, in the Mount Pleasant area, and it gets 7th and Main as they're intersecting, just with downtown in the sort of back right background, and to the left, and this sort of that gritty East Van side to Vancouver that's always left out of those postcard images. And it's such a breathtaking photo. He's an incredibly talented photographer.
Now, we were speaking earlier about some of the neighborhoods in Vancouver, about Kits and Yale Town. One of the salient aspects of those neighborhoods are dogs and right. dog owners. Now, you're going to read a selection from this book on that topic.
Yeah, this is from the essay entitled "Dogs." It's the book is organized into three parts: neighborhoods, people, and culture. And so, basically, you know, we go neighborhood by neighborhood in the first third of the book, the different groups and demographics that make up Vancouver in the middle, and then we end with just these kind of reflections on these cultural phenomena in Vancouver, like vanarchism and like dogs. So here's here's the essay on dogs. Vancouver has very few cultural inclinations that transcend all class divisions. In fact, I can only really think of three. Pot, a casual interest in the Canucks that becomes rabid in the postseason, instant fandom, just add playoffs, and dogs. The irony is that, though a love of dogs is present in every socioeconomic layer of Vancouver, from street kid to high-tech millionaire, the specific manner in which dogs are enjoyed has become one of the prime cultural signifiers of class in the city. The street newspaper Megaphone once dedicated a whole issue to the subject of pets and their importance to the underhoused, citing everything from companionship to security, and, in that sense, going some ways toward answering Norm MacDonald's cheeky joke about the reaction of the dog to its homeless master. You know, I could do this all by myself, right? I mean, thanks for the bandana and all. Conversely, any conversation about Yale Town moves quickly from yuppies to puppies. The tiny, yapping dogs so closely identified with the neighborhood have become emblematic of its emasculated affluence. Now look, I'm not one to defend rich people, but be reasonable. They're living in 12 square feet of penthouse luxury, and you want them to keep what, a bull mastiff? Those tiny little canines, or pocket rats, as some have called them, are, at the end of the day, the only humane choice given the strictures of Yale Town living. It may be one of the few instances in history of a large group of rich people showing any kind of consistent compassion. But beyond the choice of dog size, there is doggy pampering, which is admittedly absurd and an embarrassment to every Vancouverite not partaking in it. My dear friend and TV co-host Graham Clark has a bit about watching a typical Vancouver dog owner fill a dog bowl with bottled water. "Oh, Perrier, thank you," says the grateful pooch. "Something to wash down the taste of my own ass." A few years ago, I was assigned to write the entry on dog culture in a tourist book about Vancouver. As part of my research, I visited a little strip along 4th Avenue in Kits, once called Rainbow Road and the mecca of hippie counterculture, where doggy luxury now reigned supreme. On the north side of the street sat an accessory shop filled with expensive dog toothbrushes and designer coats and harnesses that wouldn't have seemed out of place in one of the sex shops on downtown Granville Street. Only in this case, the relationships the harnesses were meant for were built around love and long-term commitment. Directly across the road was Three Dog Bakery. I assume the name is an allusion to Three Dog Night, though I don't see how or why. Inside, there was a freshly baked selection of gourmet dog treats, each of which looked more like a wholesome homemade cake or cookie than anything made by Mr. Christie. John Murphy, a very talented Vancouver playwright and performer, does a wonderful piece in which he plays an angry, sardonic homeless man inside just such a doggy bakery. The unsubtle thesis, obviously, is that we're letting our fellow humans languish and starve while spoiling dogs rotten. The finer, more delicate point that he captures is the porous border between cynical, embittered Vancouver and naive, optimistic Vancouver. At one point in the monologue, the trench-coated homeless man sidles up alongside of one of the patrons in the bakery. She's been taken aback by a counterperson asking if she'd like a personal birthday greeting for her dog written in doggy edible icing on his cookie. "What's the matter?" growls the street person. "Can't your dog read?" Even though she's only hinted at, the audience can see the woman's struggle between embarrassedly identifying with the man's gruff but totally reasonable sarcasm, or else throwing herself whole hog into the experience of spoiling her pet, and thus joining the happy leagues of affluent dog owners enjoying their lives double time in human and dog years simultaneously. There are two ways to look at Vancouver's yuppie puppy phenomenon as it sits next to the social cruelty of the downtown east side. Being generous, we could say that under a set of circumstances where homelessness and alienation and atomization seem so big, one little dog to take care of is a realistically sized vessel for love and altruism. Less kindly, we could recall Dr. Jennifer Melfi, Tony Soprano's psychiatrist on HBO's mob drama, reading with panic an essay in a psychiatric journal about the ways in which sociopaths employ a pathetic sympathy for animals, as her mafioso patient did over the course of the series, with ducks, a horse, and even a little dog, to mask their lack of empathy for the people they destroy. Either way, I'm comforted by the fact that Vancouver's street people tend to have big, tough, hungry mutts, while the rich have tiny, shaking, inbred things not used to walking on concrete. If it ever really came down to it, there'd be no contest.
Thanks very much, Charlie. Now, I'll never be able to look at dog harnesses the same again.
Well, if I've only accomplished that, it'll have been worth it.
I've been talking with Charlie Demers about his book, Vancouver Special. Vancouver Special is published by Arsenal Pulp Press and can be found at your local bookstores.